Talk given Saturday, 5th July, 1980. The Rigvedic Aryans, who established kingdoms throughout India after their entry, established a very complex ritual system of worship throughout the land. In this system of worship, there was one ceremony which was called the worship of the quarters, that is, the directions of space, north, south, east, west, the nadir and the zenith. And each particular direction was said to be under the rulership of one of the Rig Vedic gods. This was a system of ritual worship for the layman, and if he carried this out, he looked to protection for himself in his everyday life, for good luck, and for good fortune, success in battle, and so on. Now, in a city called Rajagaha, which the Buddha visited quite often, that is to say, he went there for alms in the morning, for his daily food. In the city of Rajagaha, there were two upasakas, that is, lay followers, a man and his wife, who were devout lay followers of the Buddha. But they could not persuade their son, by name Sigala, to go with them to listen to the Buddha when he spoke. The reason the son gave for not wanting to go was doing homage to them, to the Buddha or to the other monks, doing homage to them would make my back ache, my knees stiff. I should have to sit on the ground and soil and wear out my clothes. And when at the conversations with them, after so sitting, one gets to know them, one has to invite them and make them presents, and so one only loses by it. The father was very distressed about this, and finally he hit upon a plan. On his deathbed, actually, by which he might succeed in getting the Buddha and his son Sigala together. And so on his deathbed, he told his son to carry out the worship of the quarters. In this worship, one went to a sacred river and sprinkled himself, his head and his, and of course therefore his clothes also, with holy water. And he clasped his hands and went through the whole ceremonial asking for protection and help from the regents of the quarters, of the six quarters. Now, one day the Buddha entered Rajagaha. As he was entering Rajagaha, he saw Sigala standing there doing this with his hair and his garments wet and carrying out this system of worship. So he asked, he said, the Buddha said to him, why do you carry out this worship? And Sigala answered, my dying father said I should do so. The Buddha said, but in the religion of an Aryan, the six quarters should not be worshipped thus. Notice that the Buddha uses the word Aryan in the old sense, meaning worthy. And the worthy one was the one who was a ploughman, who obtained his living by tilling the soil. He was the worthy one. He was also the noble one, but to be distinguished from the Kshatriya class. To be distinguished from the Kshatriya class, who are the rulers and administrators of the country. This was nobility in terms of living a noble life, making an honest living. So Sigala asks the Buddha, how then should they be worshipped? Now, the Buddha, with his usual psychological insight, said, inasmuch as the Aryan disciple has put away the four vices in conduct, inasmuch as he does no evil actions from the four wrong motives, nor pursues the six channels for dissipating wealth. Note, he adds this point, dissipating wealth. He was talking to an ordinary layman. Avoiding these 14 evil things, he is an encompasser of the six quarters. Encompasser in the sense that he includes within his purview all the six quarters in right relationship, in friendliness. Then the Buddha proceeds to mention the four vices, and those are the usual ones which come in all the texts in connection with the life of the monk: to refrain from taking life, to be harmless. Next, not to take what is not given freely, which means, of course, also to avoid the avoidance of all theft. Not to be self-indulgent with regard to all the sense pleasures through sight, hearing, touch, taste, smell, and so forth. And to avoid lying speech. So the four vices are there: the destruction of life, taking what is not given, sensuous indulgences, and lying speech. The four wrong motives. Now, this is a very interesting point. Evil actions follow through acting from out of partiality, out of enmity, out of stupidity, and out of fear. And in one of the discourses entitled The Delectable Discourse, the Buddha declares that in the perfected Holy One, you will find nine things which are quite impossible for him to do. And the first five which he mentions are the usual five which you find in the texts about the destruction of life, stealing, self-indulgence in connection with speech and in connection with intoxicating liquors and so forth. And the The other four are actions which are due to partiality, enmity, stupidity, and fear. These will never be found in the one who has trained himself properly and has purified his whole psyche. Then the six dissipations of wealth. Now this applies not only to the 25th century applies not only to 25 centuries ago, but applies today also. First, addiction to intoxicants. Second, frequenting the streets at unseemly hours, or particularly prowling about at night. Third, haunting pleasure resorts and fairs, where there are any number of temptations. That's the third. The fourth, gambling. The fifth, evil companions. And the sixth, idleness. And the Buddha goes on to say that intoxicants lead to loss of wealth, to quarrels and brawls, lead to disease, and to impaired intelligence. Prowling around unseasonably, he himself, as well as his family and property, are unprotected. He is the sort of person who is suspected of crimes. Crimes are often fathered upon him, although he may not have committed them, because he's a man who prowls about at night. See, one must remember that in those days there was no police system or anything like that as we have today. False rumors are spread about him, and he meets with many troubles. Then, as regards gambling, if the gambler wins, he begets envy and hatred. If he loses, he bemoans his losses. His actual substance is wasted. He is despised by friends and by those in authority. And this is the next point is an unusual one. His word has no weight in a court of law. And the last, he is not sought after in marriage, since he cannot afford to keep a wife. That is to say, he is not sought after by the parents of eligible girls, because they don't think that a man who gambles and wastes his money is likely to be able to support a wife. Then there are the perils of evil companions. Any gambler, tippler, cheat, swindler, man of violence is his friend or companion, and therefore he's always in trouble. And lastly, about idleness. What should be done remains undone. What he has dwindles away, and he's reduced to poverty and deprivation. So these are the 14 things that the Aryan disciple must avoid. Now we come to a very interesting point, and we'll see that in some ways how modern the Buddha's teaching is. he distinguishes clearly between false friends, who really are enemies to a person, and true friends. And he says, the Buddha says, the friend who's ever seeking what to take from you, what whose words are other than his deeds, who pleases you by flattering you, who is your companion down all the evil ways, he is a foe in the guise of a friend. The Buddha advises that if one is wise, one should avoid them from afar as a path of peril and dread. Now, by contrast to such a person, a false friend, that is, the Buddha says that he who proves a comrade in your hour of need, him may you rightly call a friend indeed. And it's an English saying today, friend in need is a friend indeed. The true friend is your helper. He is the same to you in happiness and adversity. He gives you good counsel. He throbs for you. That's an interesting phrase. He throbs for you with sympathy. The Pali word is anukampako. Anukampako. And it literally means one who vibrates on account of you and your condition. For such a friend, and also, such a friend lays down even his life for your sake. I think in St. John, is it in St. John, chapter 16, verse 15, or some such reference. No man hath greater love than this, that he lay down his life for his friend. To such a friend, says the Buddha, you should devote yourself, even as a mother devotes herself to her own, her bosom's child. Now that is very, very strong language for those days, because the love of the mother for the child of her bosom, as they always say, is about the considered about the most powerful expression of human love. The Buddha then goes on, the good layman who is virtuous and intelligent and grows wealthy is advised to benefit his family and community by dividing his wealth into four parts. One, to spend and enjoy for himself and his family. One part. The second and the third parts, to conduct, to invest in and conduct his business. The fourth part, to save and reserve for times of need. These are, of course, all superbly sensible worldly advices. Anybody would care to give them today to one's friend or child or relative or whoever it may be. But it shows that the Buddha's concern was not only with monks and their particular religious disciplines as such, but with society as a whole, as a whole. In fact, this sutta, which is called the Sigalovada Sutta, it's in the Long Discourses, number 31, gives the whole domestic and social duty, the domestic and social duty of the Buddhist layman. Buddha Ghosha, the great commentator who flourished 9 centuries after the death of the Buddha, calls this the Vinaya, that is the discipline of the houseman. he who is a householder. And the Buddha's doctrine of love and goodwill between man and man in a domestic and social ethics is set forth in this sutta in comprehensive detail. Now we have something of real importance. The Buddha was a very practical person. The Vedic rituals, after all, were symbolic things, systems, symbolic systems. And there are explanations which you find sometimes in the ritual treatises known as the Brahmanas. Will give you some idea, but not much as regards their application to practical life and to society as a whole. The Buddha, of course, takes the worship of the six quarters, takes the symbolism and interprets it in a wholly human way. There are two hymns in the Atharva Veda, whose date is roughly about 1000 BC, that is five centuries before the day of the Buddha. There are two hymns in Book 3, hymns 26 and 27, which talk about the worship, or as it is sometimes called, the protection of the six quarters. Man's worship, his ritualistic worship, is a protection for the gods. It's a very interesting point. The gods are as much dependent upon us poor folk as us poor folk are dependent upon the gods for their benevolence and help and so on. In the 27th hymn, this is how they ascribe the rulership of the different quarters. The east is under the regency or rulership of the god Agni, the lord of fire. Indra is the ruler of the south. Varuna and Soma, both those gods, are given lordship over the west. Varuna is, of course, as you know, the moral governor of the universe embodied. It's a very interesting point that Varuna is the first of the great Rig Vedic gods, and he is afterwards followed by Indra. Mitra is his great companion god, and Mitra rules friendship. He rules all contracts between man and man. Man must fulfill what he says. If he gives his word, that's that. They didn't have written contracts in those days because they didn't know how to write or read, the ordinary people. So it was laid down as a religious rule that if you gave your word to any man, you must fulfill it. Otherwise, the lord of contracts, Mitra, would punish you. So, Varuna and Soma. Soma is the god of inspiration. One hears a lot about Soma being regarded as a drink, an inspiring drink. But it is distinctly stated in the Rig Veda, those Brahmins who know what the true Soma is, know that it is not something which is brewed out of a plant and which you drink. Bibbery was not encouraged in the Rig Veda. The nadir, that is the solid earth itself, which is also called the fixed point, the point of stability. You stand, you're safe upon the ground. You can't fall below it or hurt yourself. The nadir is under the rulership of Vishnu, who later on, of course, becomes the second member of the Hindu Trinity as the Lord of Wisdom and Preservation, the preservation of the order of the world, the order of the whole universe. And the zenith is under Brihaspati. Pati means master or lord or husband. And Brihaspati means a lord of prayer. We have the Thursday called in modern India Brihaspati. The day is called Brihaspati. It's the day of prayer for India, so to say. Now you'll notice that the north is not mentioned. But I conjecture that the north is probably under the rulership of Mitra. He who is concerned with friendship and the keeping of one's word with one's fellow man. And you will see in a moment why I associate the north with Mitra. It's not mentioned as such in the Atharva Veda. Now the Buddha completely changes the whole situation by saying that the six quarters represent the whole of society. The East he assigns to parents, or shall I put it the other way? He assigns parents to the East. And yogically speaking, as far as one's own body is concerned, your face and the front of your body is the East. Teachers, now this refers to ordinary teachers, school teachers, those who teach arts and crafts and so on, to the south. So, parents to the east, right in front of you. Teachers to the south, to the right of you. The south is to the right of the east, isn't it, if you face east. Wife and children, west, behind you. And as you know, those of you who have been in India, in rural India particularly, my lord walks in front and wife and children follow behind. Friends and companions, the Buddha assigns to the north. Now because the Buddha assigned friends to the north, I conjecture that the northern direction is under the rulership of Mitra, who is Lord of Friendship too. But of course with these symbolical systems, they are all arbitrary. You can make your own system exactly as you please. So very much are they arbitrary that some of the texts talk only of five directions, not six. Others talk of seven directions. So you've got five, six and seven directions. And of course the ordinary four directions of north, south, east and west necessarily had to be there from time immemorial. And servants and employees, the workers, servants and workers he assigns to the nadir, the earth itself on which you stand. And religious teachers and Brahmins, he distinctly says religious teachers, he assigns to the zenith. Now, the mutual relationships between all these social groups involved are expounded by the Buddha in this way. Parents he assigns to the east. And therefore, the relationship of the parents is essentially with the children. And he says, in five ways a child should minister to his parents as the Eastern Quarter. Now notice, the child ministers to the parents. Once supported by them, I will now be their support. I will perform duties incumbent on them. I will keep up... Oh, surely that must be a misprint or a mistranslation. I will perform duties incumbent upon me.
Well, if they can't carry it out, you carry them out for them.
Oh. Yes. I will keep up the lineage and tradition of my family. I will make myself worthy of my heritage. Thank you. Now, reciprocally, in five ways, parents thus ministered to by their child show their love. The children minister, the parents show their love for the child. They restrain him from vice, they exhort him to virtue, they train him to a profession, they contract a suitable marriage for him, and in due time they hand over his inheritance. This handing over of inheritance is not merely at death, but on various other occasions too, which might arise. And so the Buddha says, thus is this Eastern Quarter protected by him and made safe and secure. And this is the word the Buddha uses, protected rather than worshipped. Because the Buddha did teach definitely that animistic gods being worshipped and so forth did not lead to the perfection of one's character or to nirvana or anything like that. In five ways should pupils minister to their teachers as the Southern Quarter, by rising from their seat in salutation when the teacher came along or was present, by waiting upon the teachers, by eagerness to learn, by personal service, and by attention when receiving their teaching. How many modern pupils do that? And in five ways do teachers, thus ministered to as the Southern Quarter by their pupils, love their pupil. They train him in that wherein he has been well trained. That is to say, they train him quite well. They make him hold fast that which is held. They thoroughly instruct him in the lore of every art. They speak well of him among his friends and companions. I don't see many modern teachers doing that. They provide for his safety in every quarter and in every situation. Thus is the Southern Quarter protected by him and made safe and secure. In five ways should a husband minister to his wife as the Western Quarter, by respect, by courtesy, by faithfulness, by handing over authority to her, by providing her with adornment. Interesting. Now, it is a fact that in Vedic India, a husband and wife had their own spheres of rulership. The husband was lord of the field. He did the tilling and the breadwinning and all the rest of it. And the wife was absolute mistress of the household. Husband himself, like the children, obeyed the wife and whatever the wife arranged and whatever the wife did and so forth. The wife was absolute mistress of the household. And another very important point, where the family prayers and ceremonial rituals were concerned, husband and wife were equal ministers. They had no problem about whether a woman shall become a priest or not. They carried out the ceremony as equals. In these, and reciprocally, in these five ways does the wife show love to her husband. Her duties are well performed, then by hospitality to the kin of both, her own relatives, her parents and relatives, and the husband's parents and relatives were dealt with and looked after on equal terms. By faithfulness, by watching over the goods he brings, and by skill and industry in discharging all her business. Thus is the western quarter protected. In five ways should a clansman minister to his friends and familiars as the northern quarter: by generosity, courtesy, and benevolence, by treating them as he treats himself. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thy own self. Interesting. Corresponding idea anyway. And by being as good as his word. Those are the towards his friends and familiars. And in five ways, his friends and familiars show their love for him. They protect him when he is off his guard. And there is a footnote to say, for example, if by any mischance he has fallen down somewhere, fallen down in the ditch or whatever it is, the friend will stay by him and see that he is safe and nobody robs him of his clothes or his money or whatever it is. And on such occasions, guard his property too. They become a refuge in danger, they do not forsake him in his troubles, and they show consideration for his family. Thus is the northern quarter protected. In five ways does an Aryan master, that is to say the master of the house, minister to his servants and employees as the nadir, by assigning them work according to their strength. And in this context, strength also includes their ability, not asking them to do things which they are incapable of doing. By supplying them with food and wages. To this day in modern India, this is done. My late brother-in-law, as I know from personal experience, carried out all these things. Not because he was a Hindu, he was a Parsi, but because it was the age-old custom. By tending them in sickness, my brother-in-law always looked after them in sickness, sent them to hospital, to the doctor, at his own expense, and took great care of them, always. And by sharing with them unusual delicacies. That is to say, on festive occasions, the servants also shared the goodies, as we may say, you see. And by granting them leave at times, when the servants' relatives had a marriage or something, some festive occasion, the master always gave them leave to go back to their own home in the village and enjoy themselves. And I know that my brother-in-law often lent them money. which they required. They made all sorts of excuses, but but he did. He never refused them. He always gave them something, which usually they did return. Sometimes not. If misfortune overtook the servant, and he was in a position unable to repay it, well, that's gone. Now you see, it's rather interesting, this sort of reciprocal relationship between all members of society. In these ways, ministered to by their master, servants and employees love their master in five ways. They rise in the morning before him. This I know from my own experience in my own home. The servants always got up before any of us got up. I'm not quite sure. Sometimes my mother or myself, we were up just before them. But they were. But if that was the, that happened, then they within minutes they were up and at it. They lie down to rest after the master has gone to sleep. They are content with what is given to them. They do their work well, and they carry about his praise and good fame. How do modern servants and employees behave in relationship to the master or employer?
They tend to soothe them these days.
Pardon?
They tend to soothe them.
Thus is the Neda protected. In five ways should the clansman minister to recluses and Brahmins as the zenith. By affection in act, affection in speech, and affection in mind. By keeping open house to them, by supplying their temporal needs. It's rather interesting. The relationship towards religious teachers and recluses, holy men, the true recluse, the holy man, you see, the affection for them and keeping open house for them and supplying their temporal needs. And reciprocally, recluses and Brahmins show their love for the clansmen in six ways. Now here we get six ways mentioned. So far it has always been five ways on each side. But this is six ways. They restrain him from evil. They exhort him to good. They love him with kindly thoughts. They teach him what he had not heard before. They correct and purify what he has heard. They reveal to him the way to heaven. Now, that completes the list of the reciprocal relationship between all members of society. Everything has been covered there. Now, the standpoint taken in this code of domestic and other relations and the reciprocal duty resulting therefrom calls for one remark. Notice that in summing up the reciprocal duties, the parable of the six-quarter worship is maintained throughout. Just as good and loving gods take compassion upon Anukampanti, they are sincere devotees who wait upon them with material and spiritual offerings, so too in all the six relations adduced, the seniors are represented functioning as little gods, the juniors or subordinates as devotees. There's a relationship of a religious nature between them. The one exception may be in the case of friends of equal in age and other respects. Because those who are your friends and familiars and are equal to you, there can't be a senior-junior relationship. Now this word anukampati is the type word for the protecting tenderness of the stronger for the weaker and means vibrating along after. That is to say, the feeling which one has for the other, you throb with a certain feeling. Well, that throb continues. It doesn't stop short anywhere. It continues all along. Anukampanti. And the kampanti is a thrilling. Thus, in emotional force, it is even stronger than our English word compassion or sympathy. And because the pulsing emotion is other regarding, a feeling together, whatever the loved one feels, it is justifiable to render the word anukampanti by love, thus taking the smaller concept up into the greater, not feeling just a little condescending pity or something like that, but a real vibrating love. The Buddha frequently claims to feel this godlike emotion. He says, Hitanukampa sambuddho yad anyan anusasati, which means, love and compassion doth the enlightened feel towards another when he teaches him. So now, this discourse, it's one of the long discourses, number 31, covers the entire social and domestic duty of the layman.